Get ready. It's time to tee it up with Keith Jones.
Coming up on today's show, we welcome back one of the top-level instructors in the country, Mark Sheftick. So stay tuned and get ready as you tee it up with Keith Jones.
All right.
Welcome to the show. So glad you'd be along. It is U.S. Open Week. Yes, indeed. We are not on the grounds at Shinnecock Hills, unfortunately. We were there the last time in 2018 when Brooks Koepka came away with the hardware. But that was a mere 5 years and five U.S. Opens after we met this hour's guest. It was back on a breezy morning, a little bit of fog in the state of Pennsylvania. And, of course, we were at a place called Marion, which is a fantastic golf course. And we're on one of our favorite places on the course, the driving range, where you see all the guys hit and you get a little conversation going and things like that. Well, the conversation turns to this hour's guest. Who knew a mere 13 years later we'd be celebrating the anniversary of when we first met Mark Sheftick. He's a renowned instructor. He's been on this show numerous times. I know he always contributes. He's a busy, busy man. We did get a chance to stop by, see him in his place of work just a little outside Philadelphia when we were up in the Philly area around the PGA Championship time. So, you know, but that's not enough. He said, hey, I can make time. I'm so busy, busy, busy with lessons. I'm going to make time to come on the show. So he's back on the show. And that was a huge, long introduction, longer than I give the outstanding high-level stars that we usually have on the show. But we welcome back, Shefty. Thanks. Thanks for making time, because I know you are a busy boy.
Keith, I always have time for you, buddy. And like you said, it was you came up. I didn't get to spend a lot of time with you, but it's always great to see you.
Thank you, my man. I was watching you in action. I love to watch instructors, especially guys that know what they're doing, like Sheftick does. And he's zapping a tree. That is Ted Sheftick. So if you know the name Sheftick, you know it from there. If not, from Marco, who is you're making your own star on the Walk of Fame, because Ry Stinson, our buddy, was on the show last week, and he's busy helping people rehab and all that kind of stuff. But we were talking about the Maryland mid-amateur that he had played in and at Columbia Country Club outside of Washington, D.C., and that he was heading up to Philadelphia to play in the Philly mid-am. So I haven't talked to him since then, but apparently he was spotted hanging out with some guy named Mark Sheftick.
Yeah, Rye's become a very good friend, super smart, really knows the stuff. We bounce ideas off each other all the time, trying to learn more about the body, prevention of injury, picking my brain on golf swing. So he was up here for the Philadelphia Amateur, which was held at Sunnybrook. It was, the funny thing about it is I was going down the second stage senior U.S. Open at Manor, where he belongs. He was coming up here and playing at Sunnybrook, where I belong. And it was just one of those weird things where, okay, I'm playing your course, you're playing my course, we're comparing notes, this and that. It was a hoot.
Yeah, it was interesting in talking with him, because I had no idea in previous conversations how good of a golfer that he really is. I mean, he's making cuts, and he's doing. I mean, anybody who listens to the show knows that you are a very good competitive golfer. You've been playing in the PGA Professional Championship for a number of years, and usually you're right in there in the mix of it, but. Having Stinson step up and say, oh, I was, you know, playing over Columbia and such. And I'm like, wow, you guys, there's something else.
Oh, right. Yeah, Rye's very good. Yeah, he can play. He's got some crazy club head speed. He's very detailed. He's into it. And, yeah, he's one of the few guys that when he talks, I listen, because he knows what he's talking about. And I helped him out with a practice round up here at Sunnybrook, going over the greens, going over sight lines, just working our way through the golf course. So, yeah, he's definitely got a lot of talent.
Oh, I see. Giving him insider local knowledge.
Well, that's what you have to do. I mean, Sunnybrook, exactly. Just trying to help him prepare, to give him all the options, you know, give him the best chances to, you know, navigate through a golf course he doesn't know.
Yeah, that's what friends do. And indeed, I actually extended the opportunity to carry his bag if he needed it, to caddy for him. And I don't even caddy for myself. So that was a huge, I don't know what out of body experience I was having at that moment when I put that in front of him. But I think he had me when he started playing in all these great amateur tournaments, legit amateur tournaments.
Absolutely. And we actually had a really cool conversation. Much like myself, Rye's extremely busy at Johns Hopkins doing rehab and doing all that stuff, and he hasn't competed in a while. And we were talking that evening about, okay, when I get to that first tee, you know, what do you do to handle nerves if things are going a little sideways? What are certain cues that you are using to help get yourself back? I mean, we talked a lot about mental preparation for tournament. I mean, the only way to really get prepared for a tournament is to play. You know, it's a different pressure. You're under the gun. Things change. Brain works faster. Eyes are looking around. So we talked a lot about, you know, not only the golf course, but what are strategies we can use that, you know, I haven't competed in a while. I haven't had a lot of time to practice. So if I get out there and the ball starts going left or right or this or that, you know, what are you doing to get yourself back in check?
Yeah, self-correction, that is a thing that not a lot of recreational players have. I've struggled with that over time. And also the great professionals, the successful players, both amateur and professional, are able to self-correct and be successful in that mindset at the time.
Well, Keith, when the bell rings and you got to go out and perform, you know, you train really hard, so your skill set is ready to go. And then, as we call the brain, the 15th club, that's kind of what makes or breaks you. You know, the guys that, the men and the women out there, whether it's an amateur tournament or a pro tournament, your brain really determines what you can and can't do. And when you haven't competed in anything in a while, sometimes that pressure gets unfamiliar. And then what do you do to handle that is just a great conversation.
Yeah. So how does that conversation go? How do you handle it? I mean, you need to provide a little insight in this portion of the show, because that's important for people.
Well, the one thing is I like to tell to Rye or my students is, number one, you don't have to be perfect. You know, you play to spots. You know, I play to ranges. I always give myself a little leeway. You know, I try to work myself in the round. You know, the first hole, where can you miss it? Like, most holes have a bell outside. Right's better than left, or left's better than right. So if I start out, and number one, respect that you're nervous. Don't hide from it. The first shot doesn't have to be the longest. You know, and I said, with the skill set that we have, if we want the ball to go left, we can make it go left. If we want to make the ball go right, we can make it go right. I said, so you need to really, when you get on that first tee, you know, commit to something. It doesn't have to be the sexiest, the longest. To just get it in play, put it in the middle of the green, see if you can make a simple par. And if you make a bogey, it's not the end of the world. The big thing that you're trying to key away from are just big numbers or mental mistakes. We've trained all this time to, like I said, create a high level skill. We can go out there on a range, we can do all this stuff, but now we got to take that ability and trust it out on the golf course. And if you are a little nervous, you know, I think your pre-shot routine, the questions you're asking yourself, trying to get away from the outcome, and then just see if you can just string along a couple solid shots, you know, maybe a conservative target till you get to that comfort zone by the third or fourth hole where you start really settling down, the brain's not racing, and then from right there you can kind of figure out what to do from there.
See, I find that interesting. You just said that about the third or fourth hole where you settle down, and I've experienced that where you're out of the gate and you really, you know, you want to go at it, and you want to go at it, and I think really parallels kind of horse racing, right? If the horse comes out of the gates too quickly, they'll burn out quicker and won't have enough to get down around the last turn into the finish line. So that's a really, really interesting point you just brought up. So be more methodical, be how, as you are approaching your tee shot to open up the round, which is always nerve-wracking, no matter if two people are watching you or 302 people are watching you.
Yeah, I mean, you just want to be really committed to what you're doing. I mean, you're trying to give your brain information. Your brain's trying to work for you, not against you. And you start asking yourself the right questions, like, okay, if I don't hit it perfect, where do I need to go? Where's the fat part of the fairway? And, you know, there's been many times, Keith, in tournaments where I'm on the first hole and, you know, I know that right's better than left. So even if it goes in the right rough, I'm okay with that. So my expectations are going to be manageable. They're going to be in a position where I give myself enough leeway where I can find a way to swing free through the golf ball versus, once you start trying to guide the ball, you've already missed the shot. You know, you get tight, you get tense, you get short, you get quick. Your hands come down, your body doesn't get in position, you don't turn your body. All the bad things happen because of tension and fear and anxiety. And I told Rye that, you know, anxiety is nothing more than trying to predict the outcome of the future that hasn't happened.
Interesting.
So if you think about the anxiety that happens in a shot, you're already wondering, what if I hit it out of bounds? What if I hook it? Well, how about that? Okay, you got to keep it right on this hole. Like when we did our practice round at Sunnybrook, when you have a high level player, most of the practices are basically off the tee and around the greens. What are my sight lines? Where can I hit the golf ball? And then, you know, what shots around the green am I going to deal with? Where do you think the pins are going to be? So with Rye, we were on number one at Sunnybrook, and Rye hits the ball pretty long. In the first shot, you know, he bombs a driver down the middle, firm fairway, rolls into a fairway bunker. I said, now let's hit a three wood. So let's go in the same line that, you know, so if you bomb a driver, you're going to have 100 yards in. If you hit a three wood, you're going to have 120 yards in. So your scoring average from 80 yards is going to be almost identical from 120 yards. But if you hit into the bunker, now you bring in bogey or worse into play. So 80-yard shot versus 120-yard shot, you're still going to have the same scoring average. So let's take the bunker out of play so you can swing a little more free with the three wood. And not worrying about or trying to steer it away from the bunker. So we talked a lot of strategies, you know, to where what's going to create a free swing. So if I know that if I have a lot of room to work with on the first hole, free wood doesn't get me in the left bunker. Even if it runs into the rough, you still have a short wedge.
All right,
middle of the green. Go ahead.
Yeah. So if he hits it into the bunker on the drive, you're telling him to take a three wood into the bunker. Am I following that correctly?
No. I'm sorry. Driver puts him in the bunker.
Yeah, driver. I see. Oh, gotcha. Take the three off the tee, not the driver. Gotcha.
So if he hits a driver, he can reach the bunker, and the fairway kind of slopes to the bunker. So then you might feel like, well, I might have to cut this a little bit, or I might have to hold off the face. If you hit the three wood will not reach the bunker. That leaves you 120 versus 80 yards in, you know, for as long as he hits it. And I said, then, you know, you don't have to worry about that. Then you don't have to try to manipulate the club face or your hands. So it creates a free swing. And then when we went out, you know, just through the golf course, there are certain parts where, okay, here's the ranges you want to go on the greens, you know, whether the pins, Sunnybrook's an old style golf course. Greens are built back to front. If you miss them east and west of the golf, of the green, you have a lot of slope. So you want to stay in front of the green. And then I also showed them, the architect built, you know, these holes to enter the green a certain way. It gives you a freer look at the middle of the green versus if you hit it right, you got to go over a bunker or vice versa. So we just talked about, you know, these are good places. These are good areas. These are good zones to try to drive the ball. And even if it's in the rough, that still gives you a good angle to the green. So if you don't have the ideal pin, you know, we can still put it in the middle. Do putt and get the heck out of there.
Well, yeah, it's Mark Sheff. Yeah, exactly. But Sheff knows what he's talking about. With Mark Sheffnick, we'll be back after this quick break. And we're back with Mark Sheftick, a top-level instructor, a pretty regular contributor. I don't know if he's been doing this for 13 years. Apparently, according to our watches, it's U.S. Open week. And matter of fact, I want to get this out. Since it's U.S. Open, it's always Father's Day as well. So happy Father's Day to everyone and to this guy who's on the show with us. He has a prodigy. So, you know, there's another chef that come along that apparently plays some good stick.
Ty, my son, is he's 17 years old. He's playing high level golf. He's a little bit of a late bloomer like his dad, but you know, perseverance, dedication. I try to tell everybody you're playing a difficult game. You know, you're going to go through a lot of adversity, and they're the things that are going to really teach you the most. And right now, I'm trying to. Yeah, as tournament season is upon us, you know, I'm trying to get less time on the range, more time on the golf course, a lot of time with the wedges. You know, you see a lot of the younger kids on the range with a camera, always filming their swings. What the one thing that a lot of the kids are lacking is, how do you score? How do you get the ball in the hole? Everyone's trying to search for a perfect swing, which there is no such thing. So we just try to make the swing as efficient as possible. And then, you know, how to think. 50% of your score's putting. So what I try to tell Ty and my students is, you know, what part of the game is going to influence your score the most? You got to drive the ball well. 100 yards it in, you have to be solid. You're on the putting green, speed, controlling the face, learning how to read a green. If you can drive the ball well, you're good with your wedges, and you can putt, that means you can win. And that's primarily what we're really trying to, you know, focus on in his preparation to his tournaments.
Which he's done very well. Obviously, he's playing at the junior level, but are we looking at potential scholarships to college? Would you go that route?
Well, I'm learning a lot. I mean, I've taught a lot of college kids, and a lot of things have changed. There's a thing now called a portal where kids are in and out, and then you have the NIL. Now the kids are getting paid, and it's, you know, COVID made a little things difficult with college now with the portal. So before, in my era, you know, you do well through high school and you get recruited. Now with the portal, kids can transfer from college to college. So it's getting harder for coaches to take a high school kid. Well, here's a kid in the portal who's already played a year of college golf. He's doing well. So now they're up against a lot more. They're allowed to have 9 guys on the team. There's X amount of scholarship money. It's very competitive, and what's very interesting, Keith, is in the Philadelphia section, if you look at the Philadelphia Junior Tour, there is a wait list. There is physically a wait list through almost into October. Almost every event has a wait list. So that should tell us how popular golf has become. And a lot of the big tournaments, I hate to say it this way, you know, when the sign up for a tournament is on, if you're not on the computer within the hour, you're probably not going to get a spot. So it has gotten, I mean, it is definitely grown to levels that it's hard to believe.
Yeah, see, it's interesting you say that, because golf is not the mainstream sport in college, but it's affected. And I'm glad you brought that up, Shefty, because we hear about football and the transfers and a lot of basketball, well-known basketball coaches have gotten out. And actually, we had Duger Balcom on the show a couple of weeks ago, who was at Citadel lastly and was at VMI before that, who got out of the game particularly for that reason, because it's a whole shell-shifting game. But it's also interesting you mention that, because the one thing that when I talk to coaches, they mention is this fluidity, right? And there are... And talking to parents, there's not the opportunity. You know, Shefty's a parent too. Just what you were talking about. The high school senior no longer is a commodity the way they used to be.
Amen.
It's unfortunate, but that's, you know, that's where we're at with things. But, you know, you just have to keep playing your best game and such. And when we come back after the bottom of the hour, I want to get into some green. You mentioned green reading, so important. And I think that gets missed a lot of times, because people think they're reading it correctly, but they miss putts anyway. And there's a number of reasons for that. And, well, Well, we're going to put Shefty on the spot, I guess, and he'll give you kind of an abbreviated lesson. Usually he's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars, but, you know, I trick all these guys to come on and they start talking because they like to talk and, you know, they give you information for free. Like that Rice Stinson guy, he's a talker too. So, you know, we know that, and we take the shots when we can, Shefty. We take the shots when we can. But we are with Mark Sheftick, renowned instructor, and we'll be back for the second half hour with a lot more from Chef.
Hi, this is John O'Hurley reminding you you're listening to Tee It Up with Keith Jones. I haven't been this excited since I discovered I couldn't lick my elbow.
The Dalai Lama. So I'm on a first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter.
The Lama.
Long. Into a 10,000 foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. You know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga Galunga.
All right, it's time to start the second hour of the show, spending it with Mark Sheftick, renowned instructor, top level instructor, currently out of Sunnybrook outside of Philadelphia, a guy who has played in a lot of PGA professional tournaments and has all that wisdom to go along with that. So when I was up to see you, I don't know, almost 3 weeks ago now, I watched you give a lesson, and I don't think I was, you know, in the shadows, so I, you know, you didn't really know I was there, but I watched you take the young man, who was really an elderly gentleman, but the young man outside and work with him and such. Practicing off of grass is totally different than practicing off a mat. I love going to driving ranges and watch people whack the ball around, but it's a little painful as well. What are your suggestions?
Well, I mean, grass is the real thing. You can't lie to a piece of turf. I mean, a mat can save a fat shot. So when you use technology, video, force plates, TrackMan, you really need a controlled environment. And what I like to do is, we don't like to guess. That's a bad thing. So the student comes in, you ask them, him or her, what you know, what part of the game do you feel like they need the most amount of work on? And most people, you know, they want, well, my swing's off and da-da-da. So you start working on that. So a lot of times I will start in a controlled setting on a mat with some technology, and I'm just basically watching what they do. And that's going to give me a strategy on how to move forward. I mean, yes, they want to get on the grass, but the golf swing happens in 1 second. There's a lot going on. Sometimes people have a really good swing, but their timing might be off. Some people, you don't need technology because they just have a terrible setup, and you can just fix that, and you're already making them better. If I can, once I sort of get a game plan with what they're doing, also, I think people being able to hear or see or feel what they're doing helps deliver my message. Because you can tell somebody till they're blue in the face that you have a short backswing. And if you show them how short it is or how long it is or how inside they take it, they create that picture, and that picture helps the learning process a little more. And then what we'll do is, maybe the second half of the lesson, maybe go to the grass, set up a workstation, teach them how they should be practicing, what they should be practicing. So let's not go to the driving range and start beating balls. Here's a little workstation. Here's some things that we can do so we're practicing and training efficiently. So instead of going to the range for 3 hours and getting worse, let's go to the range for an hour, get some good work done so those motor skills, those patterns we're trying to improve, do improve.
So it's super important to get together with a PGA professional and get a lesson or some lessons and such. But there are some people that either can't afford it or won't do it and such. But how do you keep them going down the right path versus the wrong path? Because it's repetitive. It's repetitive.
Well, the wrong path would be practicing poorly.
Right.
I'll give you an example. You know, one of the questions I like to ask a lot of people that I don't, you know, when they come in for the first or second lesson, you know, what are we doing in this lesson? A lot of people, are we trying to improve our score? You there, Keith?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening. I'm just paying great attention to you. I mean, you have the floor. You have the podium, Jeff. Good.
I'm sorry. When someone comes in the lesson, and we're trying to find out what they want to do with this lesson, and then a lot of times I'll explain to them, you know, what a handicap really is. And a handicap, it's not a number. So everyone will mark, I'm a 15, I'm a 20, I'm a 10. You know, I always try to say a handicap is a representation of your skill level. So T-ball, long approach, short approach, scrambling, putting, short game, course management and equipment. So we look at, I said, now what out of all those areas, where are we lacking the most? You know, where are we losing shots? And if someone says, Mark, I'm a 15 and my goal is going to get down to a 10. Okay, where are we going to pick up 5 shots consistently? And a lot of it's short game and a lot of it's putting. And a lot of times I'll look at their equipment, and if I see someone playing a 4-iron, I'm like, why don't we try a hybrid or a fairway wood? That's going to be a heck of a lot easier. So in that, you know, so when someone is trying to train and go down the right rabbit hole, you know, anytime you have factual evidence, factual information, better information, you're going to move the process more efficiently. If you're out there on YouTube, on Instagram, trying 15 different tips on the backswing and on the downswing and the follow through and this and that, you're probably going to get worse before you get better. You're going to get so frustrated that you finally might get a lesson. But, you know, when someone does something over and over and over again, you develop a pattern, and that pattern sort of becomes your swing. And when you have a pattern that's very dominant, it's very hard to break. So we try to see what the old pattern is. We try to see what the new pattern is. And there's a reason why when you watch the best players in the world, men and women, they have workstations, they have detail, they have things that they know, they learn, they understand their swing, they understand their tendencies, they have certain feels they need to do to make sure they stay in a good spot. So sometimes lessons aren't always about changing. You know, maybe we're just trying to improve a couple different things, but when someone leaves a lesson, here's the drills I want you consistently doing. Let's see what that takes us. I need X amount of reps on these drills, and let's see if that gets the new pattern a little more dominant.
Talking to Mark Sheftick on Tee It Up with Keith Jones. See, I told you the guy knows what he's talking about. So I want to go back to the Sunnybrook member, formerly of Marion, now Sunnybrook. I want to go back to the Sunnybrook patient that I saw you working with when I was overlording you without you knowing. But you took him outside and said you were working on some swings. So were you working on consistency for him? Well, what was he doing that you had to address, and how did you address it?
I wish I remember the guy I was working with. It was so normally when I take him outside, I try to build a little workstation, and hopefully, you know, we're starting to, I'm not exactly sure what the lesson was on. I forget who I was with.
It was the lesson before the owner's kid. So,
oh boy,
exactly. Never mind. He has a lot of it was weeks ago, and so, see, this is what happens. You know, he's so in his world that you know. So, so let's just take it as a raw person, and then how do you get them to hone their swing?
Well, I think they first have to buy into what you're telling them. I think. In a golf swing, I think one key, Keith, most people show up at the golf lesson, 9 times out of 10, they have a terrible setup. Okay. If the setup is bad, everything else is bad. And then you start looking for matchups, you know, what kind of grip style, how do they move their body? So you're trying to formulate, you know, is there a knee problem? Is there a back problem? Are they too flexible? Are they too immobile? So you try to get them in a setup where, number one, they can move. Number two, they can control the club face with a certain type of grip. And then you kind of see what their intention is. There are some people that come in and they swing as hard as they can at everything. And there's certain people that come in that don't swing too fast. So you're really learning what their mindset is, what their expectations are, how much are they going to practice. But if you overload somebody in a lesson, you're never going to see them again. They're going to get worse. So you really try to deliver one simple message. I've given so many lessons on just getting someone in a better setup, whether they're too close or too far, terrible grip, you know, their knees are too bent. Where I have some people where they come in and they can barely move because they have so much restriction in their setup position. So once they get him in a pretty good setup, then we kind of see what changes. And then basically you really try to detail one major thought that you think is going to really make a difference. Because if you change one thing, you're going to change other things. And if that one change happens successfully, okay, they're not overloaded, they're not confused, they're not thinking too much. And then little by little, other things just sort of take care of themselves. So that's kind of the art of just trying to figure out how much are they going to practice? Are they going to practice? You know, some people would say to me, Mark, I need to see it. I need to hear it. I need to feel it. So you try to speak in a language that they can relate to. But I think when someone starts getting a lot of different thoughts in their heads and they're looking at too many components, you're going to lose the student and the lesson's going to go in the wrong direction.
That's a good point.
If you get confused in a lesson and you're out there, it's just not going to work.
Yeah, I hear you on that. Well, this guy you were working on, you did change his setup a little bit, and you changed his grip a little bit. So I saw both of those, those in action, and he started hitting it pretty good. And then, you know, the problem is people fall back into their habits, if you will, and that's the issue. You got to break through, because golf's a hard enough game as it is, and then you just have to stay with it. And then even if it's uncomfortable, you have to try to figure it out.
Well, I think I love what you just said there, and you're spot on. I think sometimes when you do something, you know, you try not to use the word change. You try to use the word improve. That just sounds a little more positive.
Nice.
And you know, if it's different and it, you can tell the person's really struggling with it because of a physical limitation. I took a lesson one time with somebody, and I stopped the lesson within a half an hour, because he was trying to get me in positions my body was just not going to get into. So about 20 minutes in the lesson, I looked at him. I said, how much do I owe you? This lesson's over. And I left, because I'm like, my body's saying this isn't going to happen. And if I continue to do this, I'm going to have a very short career. But if you put someone in a different or an awkward position, yes, the feel, I'll give you an example. I had a guy that was standing so close to the golf ball and he couldn't even move his body. So I got him at the right distance. And then he really struggled for the first 5 to 10 shots. And then he started to figure it out a little bit. Then I put him back in his old setup and he looked over at me. He said, I can't hit a ball from here. I'm like, now you got it. So you do a little, you let them do what they want. You make a little change, whatever it is. And then you sometimes put them back to where they originally were. And they'll look at me and they're like, well, how did I ever hit a ball from here? I'm like, that's why you're here, because you can hit a ball.
Interesting. Yeah, that's the positioning. Again, it's so important. And it's only inches you're talking about. And I want to shift gears, speaking of inches, to putting and trying to figure out how to read greens. So I see, you know, if the grass is growing away, it's eroding towards the sun, so you have that shading and all kinds of other stuff. So from an infancy standpoint, how do you teach reading the greens?
Well, number one, reading a green is all based on speed, right? The harder you hit it, the less it breaks. The softer you hit it, the more it breaks. So a lot of people do come in and they do talk about, Mark, I'm a terrible green reader. Well, the first thing is your speed's terrible. You know, if I'm caddying for you, Keith, and I don't know you from Adam. If I'm a good caddy, the first question I'm going to ask you is, what kind of putter are you? Do you dive the ball in the hole or are you a pretty aggressive? Because that's going to help me create a better read. I'm going to commit to a speed, and that's going to help me find the line that makes sense. And if your speed is off, the read is kind of meaningless. Also, believe it or not, I mean, I don't know why people don't get fit for putters. Do you know why? I'm going to ask you a question there, Mr. Jones. Good. Why are putters 34 and 35 inches?
I believe the answer is that's what the industry has come up with as standard. But I'll defer to the guy the professor who thinks he knows the answer. I have all these smart guys on the show, so I am the host. I'm the orator. So go ahead, answer the question.
So we were a long time ago. Was with some pretty smart people, putter designers, certain big company you know of, was Titleist, and they basically, the question was, why do you think putters are 34? You go to a Golf Galaxy or a club, all putters are 34, 35 inches. Why do you think putters are that long? And there was a lot of random answers, but no one really knew the answer. He said, well, they fit in a golf bag. I said, what? He said, yeah, 34, 35 inches actually fits perfectly in a golf bag. That's why putters are that long. And he said, most people, you know, don't have the right putter, whether there's too much. You know, putters have 8 degree aloft to 0 degree aloft. And it's like a wedge. You know, if you are consistently delivering the putter with the wrong amount of loft, you know, someone who likes to forward press their hand should, you know, let's say someone who really likes to forward press their hands, I'm going to give them a putter with 6 to 8 degree aloft. So when they forward press their hands, the loft is going to be 1 degree. Let's say someone who doesn't like to forward press their hands, the loft of the putter is going to be 1 degree. But if my delivery to the ball is very consistent and I can control the face and then I can control the speed, then I can read a green. But if I'm constantly, you know, if the delivery into the ball is inconsistent, you know, the ball is going to hop, it's going to roll, it's going to go too far, then people right away basically make the assumption they can't read a green. Reading greens isn't that hard. Look, every green is built for drainage. There's going to be a high point and a low point. Water's going to funnel off the green. But you cannot build a green that's going to sit in a bowl. Water's going to collect in the middle, and it's going to die. So the ball will roll. I mean, the water will roll off to a certain side. And if you take a little bit of time and actually walk around the hole and kind of look at it from different angles, you can actually see what's uphill, what's downhill, what's sidehill. And if you stand directly behind the ball, your eyes only see the last third of the putt. If you take 8 steps back from the ball, so instead of reading the putt right behind the ball, you're looking at the hole. You don't see the journey to the putt. Take 8 steps back, squat down a little bit, and then you will be able to see the entire putt a lot better. But at the end of the day, if your speed is poor, your green reading is going to suffer.
Well, okay, fine on that. So work on the putt. How can you work on the putting and not work on the greens at the same time? Because you got to, I mean, I obviously using a practice putting green, but still, you still got to have a green.
Well, the first thing, Keith, I tell anybody is, look, if you're in the golf, 50% of your score is putting. If par is 72 and you two putt every green, that's 36. 36 and 36 is 72. So if 45 to 50% of your score is putting, don't go to some random store and hit something on a mat and say, oh, this feels pretty good, I'm going to go try it out. Then, you know, the famous saying is you take the sticker off and it doesn't work the same. Yeah. So I would say go to someone who really knows what they're doing. There are a lot of different styles. There are inserts, there's loft, there's different type of necks. I would find something that if like Mike Little, a close friend of mine, he fits me for my putter, and the putter I was pulling all my putts, and then Mike did a little thing. He said, Mark, this putter doesn't fit you. He put me in this other style putter with a different kind of a plumber's neck. All of a sudden, I started to roll the ball a lot better, and I would have never figured that out. So little things like that, getting fit for a putter. If people are going to spend $600 for a driver, go get fit for a putter. And then least you know that the piece of equipment I have fits me. I can start the ball in line. It looks right. My eyes line up well. And then that's the delivery loft of the putter, where I'm not adding too much loft. I'm not de-lofting it. Yeah, I like to forward press my hand. Do I like a fat grip? Do I like a small grip? So get that under control.
Jeffy's in trouble with the industry. We'll talk about that when we come back after this break. We're back for our final segment. It's been a pleasure to spend the hour with this guest, Mark Sheffick. He's just, you know, it's just a conversation we're having, you know, that type of thing. He's a top-level instructor and a fairly regular contributor to the show. Once he's not taking all the money from all the people, getting lessons from him, you know, one of those deals from that standpoint. But you made an interesting statement, and you know, people don't have all kinds of money to throw around for new clubs. And drivers are $600+, which is insane, except for Northwestern, mm-hmm. which we'll talk about in the upcoming weeks. But The putters, well, if you get a Scotty, forget it. It's going to be way over 600. A bunch of guys have that. But if you get a putter these days, it's still going to cost you hundreds of dollars. But what I heard from you was, hey, people, the putter's much more important than the driver. And that's where the industry is not going to be happy with Shefty, but statement well received.
I think I would, my way of saying it, I'd say putting is equally as important as the driver. If you can't get the tee ball in play, what are you putting for? Triple bogey? So I would never say putting is more important than the tee ball, but I mean, it's still 50% of your score. It's one piece of equipment you primarily use on every hole, and it's kind of important.
You didn't say it was more important. You just said you felt like it was more important to have a top-notch putter than a top-notch driver. That's what I translated out of that. Nothing wrong with that. I think that's good advice myself, because the driver is the one club that most people should not hit and always want to hit first and foremost. But I defer to the top level instructor in this case.
I mean, 100%. I mean, the drivers today are kind of maxed out. You know, don't be fooled. If someone comes up and say you're going to get 20 more yards, probably not. The face can't get any thinner. The head can't get any bigger. The shaft can't get any longer. So right now what they're doing with drivers is, how consistent can we make them? If we go at it harder, can we find the ball? But a lot of people will go get fit for a driver, but what people will not do is they will not get fit for a putter, which doesn't make sense to me.
Well, exactly what the line of questioning we were going for. Exactly. So, all right, so people say, I didn't realize you could get fit for a putter. What do I do? How do I do it?
Well, there's a good question. Again, I'm fortunate that my close friend, Mike Little, Keith, I'm a big believer in forming a team around your players. No one makes one person successful. Most people have a team around them. Mm-hmm. So in the Philadelphia area, when all my students, I had them go have Mike go work with their putting, including my son, because he's better at it than I am, and he kind of specializes in it. But no matter what area you're at, you know, there's probably, you can research it online. You can find someone, you know, that has a Sam Putt Lab or a Quintech some technology that's going to give you a better reading of how that putter's performing, what the ball is doing off the face, how heavy the putter is. I'll give you a quick story.
Yeah.
Good friend of ours, I'll use his name anyways. Braden Shattuck,
That loser? Okay, never mind. Go ahead.
So he went and won the National Club Pro, and he had a Makefield putter. But when he came back to Philadelphia, you know, he had a hard time making putts. I played in the final round with him. The guy should have shot a 62, but he didn't make a putt, and he was getting very frustrated. So we went up to Mike's place, and we looked at his putter, and basically the greens in New Mexico were significantly slower than the greens up here were significantly faster. So that putter that he was using had a very fast ball speed. There's a thing called an impact ratio. It's a fancy word for smash factor for putter. And his impact ratio was 1.83, which basically means the putter was coming off the ball was coming off the face very, very fast. So in Philadelphia, when the greens were stamping around 12, you know, when the ball came off that fast, he couldn't hit his lines. So Michael gave him a softer insert where the ball speed was less, so he could hit his lines. And then now his scoring average is 67, 66. So thanks, Mike. You know, wait, now he's kicking the crap out of all of us.
Yeah, Little does that. I got to reach back to Little. He's been busy the last number of times I've called him. Well, you know, too busy to come on the show because he's in his workshop or whatever the heck Little does in the Philadelphia area. But he's really good at it. I was talking to my putting aficionado, John Berquist, who's based out of Seattle, and he's familiar with Mike, and I think Mike was familiar with JB too. But anyway. Well, we're all familiar with Shefty. Yeah, hey, thanks for making time, Mark. Appreciate it. You're the best, and it's been great to have you on. And obviously, we'll revisit numerous times down the road. But we're just out of time. Get out there and practice your game. Practice. Take your game to the next level. And we will talk to you next week. Take care.